Day in Studio 360. Back in the olden days, before the internet, indie rock musicians had to rely on word of mouth and college radio stations and posters. John Fine lived that life in the 80s and 90s.
We were like, you know, reading fanzines, trying to connect all these dots. I've heard about this record by this band. Where can I find it? That was the thing.
I'll talk with John Fine about his new memoir, Your Band Sucks, and his shocking kind of sort of comeback a couple of years ago. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, I was in my 20s and living in New York for the first time, working as a writer for TV and magazines, when my world was rocked by this funny new TV talk show.
And now, a man who, if you ask me, would be out of a job if there was anything else to watch at this time of night, David Letterman!
The ironic, prankish, smarty-pants sensibility of Late Night with David Letterman was my sensibility in the 1980s, and it definitely encouraged some friends and me to launch a magazine we'd dreamed up called Spy. And The Letterman Show really did redefine TV comedy, not just the late-night talk shows that came afterward, but training a whole generation of writers who went on to create The Simpsons and a plurality of the other great sitcoms of the age. When Letterman leaves TV this week, it really will be the end of an era. Jim Downey was one of the original head writers on Letterman's show in the early 80s, as well as, by the way, the great writer for Saturday Night Live for most of its existence. Jim, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Good to be here.
So you and I met in college on the Harvard Lampoon, and
that's right.
About a dozen Letterman writers in the 80s, by my count, were Lampoon alumni. What was the effect of that, do you think, on the show?
Well, I would say that the virtues of it were the things that are often regarded as the downside of Harvard Lampoon, kind of a silliness, sophomoric approach to things, but with a lot of book learning
right
in there, and
right.
And silly, just it's as if people got this expensive education just to accumulate a lot of highfalutin references.
Right. I remember there was this great thing, and I don't know if it was when you were there or not, but they had a humidifier and a dehumidifier. And
that's right. Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up. That was a purely conceptual thing. We wanted to have the battle of the dehumidifier versus the humidifier.
Yeah.
And Dave comes out and announces. I think we sort of billboarded it like a fight, and then, Thursday, what you've been waiting for, the big one.
I mean, just that as an example, to say we're going to have a contest between a humidifier and a dehumidifier for an hour on network television, back when network television was a big deal, that must have been just exciting.
Well, it was exciting. It was fun to, to have someone like Dave who appreciated that in exactly the same way we did and thought that was, it was just a fun thing to do. It, didn't need any more defense than that.
But as you say, the combination of really stupid and smart in one vessel, it was
That's what's great about, I think sophomoric is a compliment.
Yeah. One of the great new seeming things about the show were the remotes, where you dropped melons off buildings and had Dave drive around talking to strangers. Other than being open to writers' conceptual ideas, what do you feel like Dave did best on the show?
Well, he was great on his feet. This is a matter of taste, I suppose, but I think he's like the wittiest, the funniest, uses language the best of all the, people in his category.
Uh-huh.
And he had a great sort of attitude. He was a wise guy.
Yep.
And a lot of there were two aspects to those remote kind of things where he would go around and to various places, just introduce the audience to strange things, and then it was Dave, making wise guy remarks.
Right.
I remember a really justly famous piece, where there was a store called Just Bulbs.
We're at the corner of Broadway Street. This woman is Judy Brooks. And Judy, what do we have here? What's the name of the store?
The name of the store is Just Bulbs, and that's exactly what we sell, Just Bulbs.
You know, Dave just went there and just kept asking her for other kinds of things.
Okay, so besides bulbs, what do you have here?
Nothing.
How about shades? Could you get shades here?
No, we are Just Bulbs. If you want shades, maybe go to a place called Just Shades.
But it was Dave, in the moment, you know, there was what you brought to the thing, the concept, and then Dave just...
improvising, yeah.
I remember one of my favorite moments, and I don't know if this will translate, but we discovered that there was a cigar shop up on the Upper West Side that claimed to have the world's largest humidor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I remember Dave just going into an Orange Julius, and there was like a really like cool kind of African American guy, like a Walt Frazier type, just uh-huh. really like cool guy. And he was just sitting there like sipping on his Orange Julius, and Dave sticks a mic in his face and says, "Sir, have you any interest in seeing the world's largest humidor?" And the guy just, without a beat, just goes, "None whatsoever." That it was, but I mean, that's the kind of stuff that ordinary people could often be very, very funny on our show.
Yeah.
But Dave he had that kind of attitude.
Jim Downey, thank you very, very much. This was great.
Oh, I do what I do.
Thanks for watching. Good night, everybody.
At the end of that first Letterman decade, John Fine was trying to make it in a band. It was the late 80s. He'd met a couple of other guys in college. They'd recorded a record. They called themselves Bitch Magnet. They made a go of it for a couple of years, but then they graduated, split up, got real jobs, moved on. Standard stuff. Except that 20 years later, this weird little college band played a sold-out reunion tour worldwide. John Fine is now a business journalist, executive editor of the magazine Inc., and he's written a lovely new memoir called Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution. John Fine, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here, Kurt.
So for the very, very few of our listeners who have never heard of Bitch Magnet, how would you describe the music you made?
We were an aggressive post-punk band that formed in 1986 and ran through 1990. If I really want to subdivide it, and I do, I would say like post-hardcore, but we're getting into the kind of gradations that are meaningless to the greater outside world.
Let's, in fact, listen to a clip of Bitch Magnet. This is called Dragoon. It's from your final album called Ben-Hur. So that was Bitch Magnet playing Dragoon from 1990. Now, Bitch Magnet was more than just some college band. According to the Cognoscenti, you actually had a real small but real influence on 90s rock. The Onion, I see, says you, quote, laid the foundation for post-rock. Do those kinds of things, the fact that, you know, you're at least a large footnote to the history of rock, does that make you feel good?
I think that to be a large footnote, you're something along the size of Sonic Youth. I mean, this is a footnote to the footnote of the footnote. I mean, it's like the 18th citation, if
yeah.
it's that.
Yeah.
But you know, having said that—
But better than nothing.
It is absolutely better than nothing. And, you know, one of the things about this book is that our records were reissued in 2011. We were asked to reunite 21 years after we broke up, and we were kind of like, okay, we'll do this. And so we toured through America and Europe and Asia. And honestly, it was astonishing that people remembered and said kind things. I mean, that's—
And that people in Tokyo and Singapore by the thousands showed up.
I would not say by the thousands.
Hundreds.
We would play in Hong Kong, and there was someone from Taiwan who didn't speak English, who flew over with like an original pressing of our first record, which we printed ourselves in an edition of 1,000. I mean, how he got that, I have no idea.
But that must have been fun, even though the fact of in your 40s going on a reunion tour around the world sounds like a, you know, an Adam Sandler high concept movie or something. But it must have been such a pleasure because you presumably weren't thinking, and suddenly this time we're going to be famous.
No, it was amazing. You know, it was a kind of reminder of the things that I really liked about this community, which I'd eventually soured on at a certain point, to see there was still that kind of connection, to share all the same references, the feeling that we all, you know, we all want to be understood. And I have very complicated feelings about this whole indie rock culture, but I felt like we all knew the same stuff. We all understood each other. And that was really moving and amazing. And that happened.
And your sales were like in the same ballpark as sales of literary novels, in the tens of thousands as opposed to the millions. So have you ever thought about an alternate history? What if you had become rich and famous in this band, not maybe Nirvana level, but Fugazi level or something? Would that have been great?
That would have been amazing. That it didn't happen was kind of all right, too. But, you know, there was a time when the world was sending me signals that if I wanted to, afford housing and food, that I should probably find something else to do with most of my time. But there are a lot of people I know who stuck with it. And I want to be clear about this. They're the courageous ones. I mean, like, I bagged out when it got too uncomfortable for too long.
But you kept in it, and I've known you for a while, but you kept in it longer than I knew. Really, through your 20s, you were still doing this.
Well into my 30s.
Yeah, into your early 30s.
I was in a band in Brooklyn called Coptic Light, and we went through Japan twice. And the second time, I was 38 years old. So, yeah, I mean, this was an enormous part of my life for, I don't know, 20, 22 years.
Yeah.
I was happy to let it ruin my life for that long.
And what's lovely about this book is you are clearly not bitter. I never got famous, or we were better than this band that did. It was a lovely decade in your life.
It was a lovely time. But if you and I were having this conversation in 1998 or 1999, I'd have a much different spin on it. Because at that point, I was very actively upset that, you know, my fantasies of what this indie world would be were not coming true.
You mean, apart from your success or lack of it, the revolution wasn't happening?
The revolution wasn't happening. The giant major labels were as powerful as ever, more powerful than ever. They were, I'm doing air quotes, co-opting some of the bands in this world that had more overt commercial potential. Those bands, Pixies, Smashing Pumpkins, Hole, those got identified with the stuff, which really drove me insane. And to be honest, it still kind of does.
You talk in the book about the band's name, Bitch Magnet, how you meant it as ironically macho, and how people have suggested to you that if not for the name, you might have had more commercial success. Do you think that?
I didn't think that. I don't really think that, but more than one person said that when they were reviewing our reissues. And, you know, it's an interesting thought. I mean, like, we would have situations where, you know, the booking agent would call me up and say, like, hey, on this next tour, I got you guys a gig at Wellesley College. And I'd be like, that's never going to happen. He's like, oh, come on, it will. Don't be a wuss. I'm like, all right, I'm telling you. And then the next day he would call me back and say, Wellesley canceled. I was like, well, yeah. The name of the band is Bitch Magnet, you moron, you know. We were 18 years old when we chose the name.
Yes.
I think we thought it was funny. There was obviously a play on machismo. I'm not sure how well that scanned.
Yeah.
It's weird. You know, as a 47-year-old man, that's probably not a name I would choose. But, like, I'm not going to walk away from it. I mean, like, we did this thing and, like,
it's a tattoo you got. You're not going to erase it. You're going to keep it on there.
If it was a tattoo, if it was a tattoo, I'd keep it. But with all the repetition, it loses it. But then I'll have a conversation with, like, a civilian and I'll see their eyes kind of go gazunga. I'm like, oh, yeah, I've got to have this conversation. All right, whatever.
You write about a thing that middle-aged people are know about, which is the charm of finding this one weird album in the one record store in town. Another thing about growing up later than you did is the fact that the entire history of rock and roll is available at a click. That must be a profoundly different thing, don't you think?
It's an enormously different thing. And speaking as someone who just spent a good 2 hours on Saturday, like, digging through incredibly obscure British 70s hard rock albums by bands no one's heard of, like Incredible Hog, great record. That's a huge thing. I cannot separate this experience from having to work for all of it. Our drummer wasn't as obsessed as the bass player and songwriter Soo Young and I were. Soo Young and I, we were, like, you know, reading fanzines, you know, like, trying to connect all these dots. I've heard about this record by this band. Where can I find it? That was the thing.
Rather than I looked it up on Wikipedia, and now I'm doing what they're doing.
And rather than I looked it up on Wikipedia and I've absorbed the entire thing and I've gone on to the next thing. I mean, like, maybe having to work for it was more important. Maybe it was important that there were fewer reference points. You know, like, you could easily sort of see what it was. I would never want to argue that more information and better access to information is a bad thing.
And you, in general, you sound optimistic about what the internet has done to the music business, to music. Although if you kept at it past 30 and you were trying to make a living or making a living, maybe you wouldn't be so optimistic. That's the sort of working yeoman musician. It's really made life tough, hasn't it?
It's made life very tough for certain musicians, and it's made life very tough for a certain class of musician that is, for instance, living off record sales. Basically, as a musician now, you have to look at it as an entirely different hustle. It is easier for a artist to find a niche audience. It is easier for an artist to have a direct relationship with that audience. And there are artists who are good at that. Not all artists are.
Yeah. Speaking of the internet, I saw that you Bitch Magnet is on Spotify, and I was interested that song we played earlier, Dragoon, is the most popular on Spotify by a factor of two to whatever was a number two. What does that tell you? Why?
I'm flabbergasted. I'm also thrilled because
I'm giving you metrics.
You're giving me metrics, and I love the data. Dragoon is a 10-minute long song. There are no vocals for approximately 3.5 minutes. It tells me that the people listening to Bitch Magnet on Spotify are serious about it. They're not looking for the pop song in as much as there was one. You know, that is a almost preposterously ambitious song. It is 10 minutes long, multiple time signature changes, like all these different passages. The vocals are completely buried and pretty much spoken the entire time when they are there at all.
So the good news is the people who are listening really appreciate you. The bad news is there's only 13,000 listens so far.
I'm happy for every one of them.
What do you think about what we call indie rock today? Sometimes it seems to me like one of those phrases like postmodern that just is so widely slung around it has no meaning. Does it have meaning?
Juan McLean, who's a renowned DJ and who was in the fabulous band Six Finger Satellite, I'm going to mangle the quote slightly, but he said a great thing, which was something like, indie rock became this thing that was what I was rebelling against in the first place, and it made me so angry. And you know, that was kind of happening in the latter 90s when like a much stronger pop sensibility sort of came in, but kind of a sort of naive pop sensibility. And like eventually like a middle of the road appears and everyone goes towards it. However, when you're 25 years old and you've built your entire worldview around this thing and it's going away from you, it's incredibly upsetting.
You are now the executive editor of Inc., the magazine, business magazine aimed at entrepreneurs. What would your 21-year-old punk rock self think of this gig?
The 21-year-old would probably be amazed that I have an actual job and also be kind of horrified by it, but that's fine. I was the last full-time band I was in before Bitch Magnet reunited was a really strange band that I'm sure the 18-year-old me definitely would have despised, and I was really into that idea. I really liked that I had found a new way to do something that was interesting.
That's rebellious, right? To know that the young you would have hated the current you.
Sometimes that's the only rebellion you get in middle age, Kurt. What can I tell you?
John Fine, it has been a pleasure, as always. Nice talking to you.
Right back at you.
John Fine's memoir, Your Band Sucks, is just out. Coming up, over the centuries, one animal has been called the embodiment of Christ, a symbol of fascism, and a cuddly couch buddy?
Actually, when you live with a hawk, they're bewitchingly complicated animals. One minute they're sort of sleek killers, and then another minute they're snuggling up with you on the sofa watching terrible house removal programs.
We'll look at how the hawk tortures and tantalizes the human imagination, and I'll tell you about my experience recently with a peregrine falcon. That's all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. You know, we love inventing creative challenges for people and then helping them see those challenges through. which is why we asked you to declare your creative New Year's resolutions for 2015. And we are following several of you. The aspiring sitcom creator in New York State, a reggae DJ in Ohio, an artist making dioramas in California, and Garmin Harigstad in Bellingham, Washington, who had made a successful career doing digital special effects for movies like Harry Potter and X-Men, but his first love is calligraphy, lettering by hand. He resolved this year to write out the Old Testament's entire book of Proverbs. And he's here with me now on the line. Hello, Garmin.
Hey, Kurt.
So how far have you gotten in the book?
Well, I'm up to about chapter 7, which is about like 20% of the book, and 30% of the year's gone by. So, you know, in one way, I'm behind schedule a little bit, but I've been spending a lot of time learning new letter forms and practicing with new materials. And so that part of it's kind of slowed me down a little bit, but in view of the whole project, it's pushed me ahead.
So what section are you working on right now?
Well, the section that I'm working right now is Proverbs 6 and 7, and it's about the dicey subject of adultery and revenge and the consequences of not being careful. And it's also, this is one of the rare parts of Proverbs where the chapter actually, in a way, tells an entire story in poetic form.
Right. Let me read part of that story. This is chapter 7, verse 6. For at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive and discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense passing through the street near her corner. And he takes the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness.
And that part, when I was listening to the other participant talking about her diorama project, mm-hmm. And I really realized that it's kind of not really a diorama, but it really lends itself to something that you can, you know, look around and move and move your head and see.
Right.
Especially the verse, I looked out through my lattice and I realized that I could take one of my calligraphy pieces and actually etch a lattice hole in it, cut it out, so I could look through that across to see another one.
Wow.
So I decided to just really go for it and go big and do illustrations. And I wanted to arrange it in a maze that actually people could walk through. And so it would tell the story as you walk through.
That's great. And given that, you know, you're going through these hundreds of wise sayings, do any of them feel like, wow, that has relevance to me right now?
Oh, yeah, there's a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and you're going to come to ruin, you know, the part about the sluggard. And in a way, it's this project hasn't made me lazy. It's actually kind of given me some motivation to get out of bed. But I find myself kind of getting stuck, like reading through email, or sometimes I end up looking at calligraphy reference too much, you know, other things that I find, or reading too much about it. Whereas I actually just need to stick my nose in and get into the work.
Well, I think what you just described can be said of every creative project by anyone ever. So, yes.
I think one of the things that really helped is that when I worked at Digital Domain on movies like The Day After Tomorrow or Stealth or something, they would take on these massively huge projects. And so they were able to estimate what they think that they could really do and make a commitment to, even though maybe at the time they made the promise that they didn't know exactly how they were going to do it, but they were brave enough to go through and finish it. And with this project, it's not quite as serious as that, but I kind of feel inspired by the challenge of it.
Well, I really wish you the best of luck, Garmin, and we will keep following you and talk to you in a few months.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a great kick in the butt for me.
That's why we're here. We're glad we could be of service. You can see some of Garmin's work in progress at studio360.org. So is there some creative resolution you've undertaken this year involving the Old Testament or not? If you feel like talking about it with fellow travelers, we've got a Facebook group for you. A whole bunch of people pursuing their writing, music, filmmaking, painting, and other projects. Search Studio 360 Creative New Year's Resolutions on Facebook, We've also got a link at studio360.org. And God only knows what I'd be without you. Last Christmas, my daughters gave my wife and me a kind of bizarre and wonderful gift, a falconry lesson. We took them up on it this month. On a glorious Saturday morning in New Hampshire, I learned to let a peregrine falcon named Scout land on my gloved hand, eat bits of baby chick's heads from the glove, and then cast her into the sky. It was kind of awesome. So I was fascinated to read Helen MacDonald's extraordinary new memoir, H's for Hawk. As in a lot of memoirs, MacDonald recounts major traumas of her life and her journey from grief to recovery, but all through the world of falconry. We sent WNYC's Sarah Montague to find out more.
MacDonald says it was the hawks first.
I was pretty much obsessed with hawks from before I can remember. I just thought they were the most beautiful things that the world had ever made.
And then it was the words.
As a child, I cleaved to falconry's disconcertingly complex vocabulary. In my old books, every part of a hawk was named. Wings were sails, claws pounces, tail a train. They were magic words, arcane and lost.
Jesses, crayons, rouse,
haggard,
bait,
seal,
imp,
feet,
tearsome,
hooded,
eyes,
yarrick.
I wanted to master this world that no one knew, to be an expert in its perfect, secret language.
These words are Old English and medieval, but falconry is an ancient art, says sporting historian and falconer Peter Devers.
It goes back into pre-recorded history. Archaeologists are always coming up with like a cave painting or something showing a guy with something on their fist. And of course, we falconers say, oh, yes, yeah, that's a falconer.
And Devos says that for as long as they've been part of our lives, they've been part of our imaginations.
Artists and authors and even musicians who have written songs and hymns and all have used birds of prey for a metaphor. Countries have used them as symbolism of the power and the majesty of their country. And, you know, aside from the lion, I can't think of any animal that's been used more broadly by man in a symbolic way than birds of prey.
I kill where I please because it is all mine. There is no sophistry in my body. My manners are tearing off heads.
Which is the terrifying, you know, fascist hawk.
MacDonald says of Ted Hughes' poem, Hawk Roosting.
But actually, when you live with a hawk, they're bewitchingly complicated animals. One minute they're sort of sleek killers, and then another minute they're snuggling up with you on the sofa watching terrible house removal programs.
Hawks' bodies seem made for this duality, tapered with razor-sharp wings, prehistoric talons, and agile heads that are constantly in motion. But when they relax, they fluff up their dense, dappled feathers like giant pine cones in tones of cream and brown and become, briefly, household gods.
They obviously are incredibly self-sufficient. They kill, but they kill without sin. They kill in a way that feels to us like it is part of the natural order.
Catherine Schultz reviewed MacDonald's book, H's for Hawk, for The New Yorker.
There is something about these birds that already seems to occupy this funny liminal space between natural history and fable or mythology. And you look at one of these birds and you think, it is amazing that you're real.
Hunting with the hawk took me to the very edge of being a human. Then it took me past that place to somewhere I wasn't human at all.
MacDonald's book is about the battle that takes place in that space between the metaphoric and the real.
I crept and walked and ran. I crouched. I looked. I saw more than I have ever seen. The world gathered about me. It made absolute sense.
The way a poem makes sense.
And I was just trying to get across that sense of everything existing in an eternal present, that there's no looking forward or looking back, that when you're with the hawk, everything is shockingly apparent and visual and right there in front of you.
I caught this morning morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple dawn drawn falcon, in his riding of the rolling level underneath him, steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy.
The 19th-century Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins saw in a kestrel hawk, or windhover, the personification of Christ. But the experience of hunting with a hawk is transcendent without mediation, says falconer Peter Devers.
There's such a sense of beauty and power and freedom about it. They're works of art. You know, walk around a hawk, look at it from the top down and the bottom up, and it's just pure beauty. And I think your mind just snaps to theirs immediately, and you want to be a part of their life.
The first time I got up close to a bird and my sponsor let me hold it, I just thought there was nothing, you know, more interesting or cooler. It just gave me this incredible feeling.
John Schwartz hunts his Harris hawk Choco near Millbrook, New York.
Oh, you're looking for food. Should we go back out and hunt? Let's go. It's such a regal animal. And to watch it do what it was created to do, you know, I think it's really fascinating. Now I'm just going to let him go from my fist. We'll see what he does. He's kind of on his own.
The hawk soars silently into a tall spruce. Almost immediately, he's swooping down, intent on his prey.
Ho! 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 That was a dove, and that was amazing.
The dove was lucky today.
So he's back up in the tree. That was fun.
When you're flying a hawk, there's always a kind of weird way that you're, part of you is there in the hawk.
But this dark and sensuous poem warns that too much love and too much identification is dangerous.
I thought I was so tough but gentle that your hands cannot be quick enough to fly for you and show that when I go at your commands. Even in flight above, I am no longer free. You sealed me with your love. I am blind to other birds. The habit of your words has hooded me.
This seductive melding is the subject of Tom Gunn's Tamer and Hawk and of much of Helen MacDonald's book.
I felt incomplete unless the hawk was sitting on my hand. We were parts of each other. Grief and the hawk had conspired to this strangeness.
She leans on it to make sense of her own grief and to make sense of her life.
The critic, Kathleen Schultz.
And as she herself starts to recover from her grief, she backs away from that position and realizes she's done a disservice to this animal, which is its own thing.
The joy of them is that they're nothing like us. And that eventually is how I saw Mabel. You know, the fact that this astonishing animal, which was so inhuman and so different from me and from everyone else, could live in this wondrously close relationship with me. You know, we were real buddies. We were real hunting partners.
Julie Shope and her husband Alan have formed a similar bond with their hawk. They are also part of the Hudson Valley community of falconers, and this morning they've invited me, along with their friends Daniel and Bonnie Shapiro, to their house by the Hudson River.
It's like taking the kids to college for the first time.
Yeah.
We're watching the release of their red-tailed hawk into the wild. Her name is Zadim.
Which means warrior princess or terror from the skies in a very ancient language.
Zadim certainly looks imperious sitting on Julie Shope's thick leather glove.
We're having the big moment now. Alan has just cut off the first anklet, and he's going to cut off the second anklet, and then she will be completely free.
And she won't know it. She will not know it.
So do you think of your relationship as sort of parental?
Yes.
So this is hard.
Yeah, it is, it is. That motherly instinct definitely kicks in. But you just have to always remember that it's a wild animal that you're borrowing from the wild.
I think falconry at heart is, it's not about control, it's not about subjection. It's about a relationship. And every time you fly your hawk free, it can just disappear over the horizon.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Montague.
Still ahead this hour, the singer-songwriter Angélique Kidjo speaks at least four languages fluently and has even made up one of her own. and she sings in them all.
It's the song that brings the language, because the inspiration comes and the first word that come out of my mouth, that's going to be the language.
Angelique Kidjo will talk and sing for us next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Over the last three decades, Angelique Kidjo has pretty much been the voice of African music. She grew up in Benin, and although she left there in the 1980s, she still sings in the languages of her youth. Unless you're from West Africa, you probably can't understand Kidjo's lyrics, but anybody can feel the sense of joy and yearning. Earlier this year, Kidjo won her second Grammy Award. On her new album, her backup band is the Luxembourg Philharmonic Orchestra. Angelique Kidjo, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
The first track on your new album, Sings, is Malaika.
Malaika. Nakupenda Malaika. Malaika. Nakupenda Malaika.
Which Mary Makeba made famous.
Yes.
When I was a little boy in the
yes.
1960s. What was the significance to you of Mary Makeba, that song, as a young singer?
Well, Mary Makeba's voice come home, I was a young girl. I mean, I was like between 8 and 9. And the first time basically I sang Mary Makeba's song was the retreat song that my mom and her group of women will use with the organization asking for women's rights. For women to have the right to marry who they want, to have the right to vote, to be human.
Really, there was no suffrage in Benin.
Oh no, at that time no. So I was they would grab me along because they say you're gonna save us from being miserable singing. So I was 8 when I become a feminist without even knowing I was part of feminism. And then Miriam Makeba's voice gave me the sense of belonging to the music world as an African little girl. For me, suddenly, she showed me the endless possibility as an African person going out of Africa to have an international career. I said, if she can do it, so can I.
Yeah. And at what point did you decide this is really what I'm going to do for, this is how I'm going to earn a living?
I mean, I make that decision unconsciously based on many different moments in my life. But when I arrived in France as a student, I kind of smuggled into the university where my friend were learning law because I wanted to be a human rights lawyer because I am somebody that believes deeply in justice. And I realized that law, the way we write it, doesn't serve justice for everybody. It depends where you come from. And in justice, the class, social class, is still something that can be a liability to somebody.
So you got to Paris, and that's where you really decided I'm going to be a singer?
Yeah, that's when I decided that singing will allow me to speak about a broader range of issues and will allow me to be the voice of the voiceless people in the world and also to build bridges among us. So for me, music is a matter of telling the story of everyone, and then we can see the similarity. Therefore, we see that we are the same.
You left Benin in your early 20s, in the 80s, and moved to Paris for political reasons, to get to see the world? Why?
Yeah, political reason was the first one, because my father always used to tell us, if you're an artist, don't be linked to a political party because they come and they go. When the communist regime arrived, pretty much it did change it completely.
Which was in the 70s, right?
Yeah, in the 70s and early 70s. The radio that we used to listen to where we jump from traditional music from Benin go to, I can't get no. It gone. And then every morning you wake up is ready for revolution. The fight continues. And I'm like, this is just like brainwashing people. And they force, it was compulsory for Beninese artists to write music about the greatness of the government and about the greatness of communism, I say.
So it was the standard Soviet socialist realism.
I'm like, no,
thing.
Hell no. I'm not going to call my father comrade. I'm not going to call my mom comrade.
Yeah.
And then the thing that it does that really was disturbing is that the break of trust between people. You come home, you know who to trust. You see somebody, you think the person is a spy. I mean, you start doubting your brother, your mother. I mean, it's so painful.
We're going to talk some more, but will you play a song first?
Yeah.
What will this be?
It will be Awalole, which means we are the leader of the future. And this song is inspired by the girls that I put to school, the teenager girl that I put to school in secondary education, because they are determined to transform their lives through education. So this song is just an appreciation for their determination.
Excellent.
Awa lo le ri egbe mi ni baba Awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba To ba fe pe gungun ni o awa ni To ba fe pe orisa o awa ni Awa lo le ri egbe mi ni baba Awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba Awa lo le ri egbe mi ni baba o Awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba To ba fe pe le ri o awa ni To ba fe pe oka o Awa Awa na ele ri awa woni ta lo fe so ire lopun o awa Awa na ele ri awa ta lo fe so ire lopun o Awa, awa na eleri awa, yeah. Ani we mero koge wagbelo. Mi ni baba awa lo le ri e o awa lo le ri e gbe mi ni baba o awa lo le ri e gbe iwo ni baba to ba fe pe gungun ni o awa ni to ba fe pe orisa o awa ni awa lo le ri e gbe mi ni baba awa lo le ri e gbe iwo ni baba awa lo le ri egbe mi ni baba o awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba to ba fe pe gungun ni o awa ni awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba to ba fe pe orisa o awa ni awa ni awa ni awa ni awa ni iye Awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba Awa lo le ri egbe mi ni baba o Awa lo le ri egbe iwo ni baba
That was Angelique Kidjo and on guitar Dominic James performing the song Awa lo le That was lovely.
Thank you.
on your last album, Eve, you went back to Benin to record the vocals with women's choirs. Has the music there changed since you were a kid growing up?
No, it hasn't changed. It evolved within the society. That's what I grew up in. But because one of the things that always amazes me is the ability of the traditional music in Africa tell the story of their time. But the thing that is amazing to me is how the message of our ancestor is still relevant in the society of today.
But like hip-hop and things must have now worked their way into the vernacular.
It is.
Yeah?
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
But hip-hop, where does it come from? Hip-hop come from Africa. When I saw hip-hop and everybody talking about hip-hop and Smurf and all this, I'm like, hey, buddy, I do that stuff in school, man. This is not new for me, to me.
Yeah.
But what I've said here is that the music of my continent have nurtured the culture of the world.
I was last week spent an hour talking to Philip Glass, who mentioned you and the music he'd made with you, this song cycle called Ife, Three Yoruba Songs. How was that? How was working with him? And how does your music, which doesn't sound particularly Philip Glassian, how do those work together?
Well, I have one thing to say. I wish that every artist that I work with, that I will work with in the future, has that enthusiasm, Philip. It is so joyful. And it makes you want to come out of your body and do more than you think you can do. And he really challenged my voice too, for me to, I realized that my voice can do so much. I didn't know it before. He wrote the most challenging piece of music I've ever sung in my entire career. It took me 3 months, 2 hours a day to learn this completely, to memorize it, and to make it my own. Because he said to me when the first time I sang the song and he was on the piano playing and I was singing it, he's like, I never envisioned it like this, but you sing it so beautifully that it brings me to when I write the fourth piece. So
well, he said working with you and people like you and not really knowing how it's going to work is what at this point is what's exciting for him. Not feeling like, I don't really know what I'm doing with her voice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And he said one thing that is really true, that together we are building a bridge where people haven't started walking on yet.
Before you go, will you sing another song?
Yes.
And this is what?
Kelele.
Uh-huh.
And Kelele means as far as we have been on this earth, as parents and as society, we all believe that investing in education of our children is the best thing to do. And if we have to work hard to pay for that education, we do that.
Let's hear Kalala.
Yes!
1, 2, 3, go!
Aburo me mojarella, kachi shei sheo jame. Aburo me mojarella, kachi shei sheo jame. Iwani omo la omo baba. Iwani omo la omo baba. Iwani omo.
That's Angelique Kidjo singing Kelele, accompanied by Dominic James on guitar. Her latest album, Sings, is out now. And that's it for Studio 360 this week. Thank you very much for listening. And if you're going to be in New York City in late May, join us in the green space for Sideshow's very first live event. Our own Sean Ramesvaram will fulfill a dream, getting NPR's Lakshmi Singh to wear a hat that says,
I'm Lakshmi Singh.
It's kind of hard to explain, but it will be fun, I promise. Plus, the show will end with a public radio spelling bee. Maybe the only time that knowing how to spell Jad Abumrad will make you a winner. Find out all the details at studio360.org/sideshow. Studio 360 is a co-production of PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Tal Malad,
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramesvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hope.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiekum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we confess our fears live on stage.
We're all going to die.
Don't be scared. Don't believe you're all alone.
Studio 360 live with Andrew Bird, Jennifer Egan, and Hurry Kondabolu. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.